problem. We were going there anyway to pick up the new Spy magazine.
I'm sorry. They don't publish that anymore.
The world I grew up in is gone.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. My name is Paul Holden Graeber, and I'm the Director of Public Programs here at the New York Public Library, now known as Live from the New York Public Library. As you know, my goal here at the library is to make the lions roar. David Carr said that they might make cartwheels, they might levitate, they might dance with an evening like Spy magazine celebrates its 20th birthday, a magazine that's celebrating its birthday, though it's not alive anymore. It's wonderful to be here tonight and to have you all here in the audience. I would like to introduce this evening by reading to you the first two paragraphs of this extraordinarily beautiful book that Miramax Books has put out called Spy, The Funny Years. And the three authors of that book are here tonight to sign the book afterwards, and I highly recommend that you get it as an advance Christmas present. Here we go. Back in January 1985, Kurt Anderson and Graydon Carter crafted notes to each other describing their vision for this new magazine, and that vision was as bold and fearless, as culture-changing as the magazine would prove to be. Some excerpts from Graydon's January 10, 1985 note, and I read it. In style, Spile will be witty, bright, the very life of the party. Spy will crackle with smartness and sophistication. Its comments will be saucy, its manner that of the flâneur of a dandy boulevardier with the mind of an atom smasher. Spy will confound social conventions while at the same time pay tribute to them. By day, Spy will investigate the great commercial machines that fuel the city, the behind-the-scenes stories in art, literature, journalism, broadcasting, theater, fashion, banking, business, show business, and the law. By night, Spy will dress up for a night on the town to seek out the stories at Manhattan's cabaret, nightclubs, theaters, restaurants, and after-hour haunts. Spy will be a spectator to a commentator on the passing parade of life in the city. I think quite a beginning, isn't it? Now, the evening. As I told you, after the event is over, and usually the discussion will last about as long as a psychoanalytical session, so about 50 minutes, there'll be a conversation between the three participants and David Carr. And right after the conversation, you will have occasion to pose some provocative spy-like questions to these three individuals and David Carr. I also encourage you to join our email list so that you might find out about some of the upcoming events. For instance, we have an event with David Remnick and David Sedaris, which is a benefit to the library. I'm also excited to say that the former president of the New York Public Library, Vartan Gregorian, will be coming to speak with David Nassau about Carnegie, the man who gave everything away, Kati Martin and Samantha Power. And I'm also very excited to tell you about a series of events we have to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Atlantic Monthly, which happens also to be the 150th anniversary of Sigmund Freud. So we have a couple of events about Sigmund Freud. We also have events about lust, which seems particularly appropriate. When you speak about Freud with Esther Perel, I'll ask you to turn off your phone if you would be kind enough. Esther Perel wrote a book with a wonderful title called Mating in Captivity. I'll leave it to your imagination what it might be about. Also an event about gluttony with Mario Batali, Dan Barber, Barbara Kafka, and Corby Kummer, and many others which you will find on your chairs if you haven't already. Now, let me introduce David Carr, who in turn is going to introduce Graydon Carter, Kurt Anderson, and George Kalogarakis. I probably mispronounced his name. And I might say that in my interactions with David Carr, he relentlessly made fun of my accent, and I must say I don't really know what he's talking about. But let me say something about David Carr, who, I'm sure that's not how you pronounce it, David Carr, writes a column on media issues for the Monday Business section of the New York Times and also covers popular culture for the newspaper. During the season, he writes a daily blog about the Academy Awards as a carpetbagger. He has been a contributing writer for the Atlantic Monthly and the New York Magazine and Inside.com. Before that, he lived in middle places and came to know New York only through Spy. He was disappointed when he moved here and found out that Spy often engaged in parody, but has since recovered. David Carr and the Spy crew.
Wow. I think we gotta add a little applause there for Paul's spoken word performance of that book. Let's give it up. I know if I ever write a book, I'm gonna ask Paul to do the books on tape. The amazing thing about that accent, I'm from Minnesota, so is he. We turned out so different. In the interest of brevity and clarity, I'll just start with what Spy did not invent. Spy did not invent Botox, cold fusion, modernism, iPods, the first reality show, the second Bush, Stephen Colbert, Frappuccinos, or the internet, the agency of which has already been claimed by someone else. But they have, I think, clearly prefigured the modern media tableau, coming up with mashups that before there were such a thing, a high-low ambidextrousness that has been baked into kind of the subsequent cultural conversation. It's easy to forget what they did. It's been ubiquitous to the point of transparency, and if you think about it, Spy has become a way of thinking, talking, and writing. It seems as natural and as transparent as the web is now. Sadly, the one thing that hasn't been replicated is the Spy cover. It's about itself, a thing, a pure marketing genius, sort of heterosexual camp and seriousness rolled into one. I thought we'd roll a few slides, or I was instructed to do as much, and then I would ask you guys to either defend yourselves or contextualize your editorial decisions, whichever.
It's Chris Elliott. And of course, it was about the 10 most embarrassing New Yorkers, back when we were a New York magazine, which we were for many years. Graydon?
First cover, Chris Elliott. No, I'm kidding. There's not much else to say. But it was Stephen Doyle's idea, who's here, I saw him here tonight, to shoot just from this angle. And it's sort of, with wonderful shadows, it had a, it sort of set the tone of what we wanted to do. And even the typefaces, which became, that we used classical typefaces rather than sort of wacky typefaces, the way some humor magazines do, it was very sort of, actually very conservative, the actual look of the type. And right from the very first issue on.
This was, we did this about a year into it, and it was, I think, the first time we had Ted Kennedy didn't in fact pose, and mostly at that time we had these famous people pose, and of course, nowadays, you'd say, oh, it's a Photoshop thing, and of course, there was no such thing then, and we basically had to hire a supercomputer in order to make that happen, And actually, it was a thing that Graydon had seen that Michael Kinsley had written somewhere about what would be the measure of true journalistic bravery.
Oh, but taking on the New York Times, of taking on the Kennedy family, and I can't remember what the third thing was.
But here we were, taking on the Kennedys in a way, and it was It was the fact that we could do this, sort of this magical realist image, was astounding. Was wonderful at the time. Next.
Yep, but just a sec though. The fact that you did this with like two sticks and a rock is great. But did you ever say to yourself, like when you look at this, God, we were so mean.
It was a small mag. First of all, the good thing about it was that it had a very small circulation back then.
Right.
And you could get away with it because it did have a small circulation, and because it, just because it was put out by people who were youngish at the time.
And there was no meanness, if to use your phrase. That kind of scurrilousness was we didn't invent anything, but. But it was rare to sort of say the kinds of things and make the kind of spectacle and mischief that we were.
Next slide.
they actually posed for that one.
Yeah, that was Tam Janowitz and the late, whatever that guy's name is.
Al Lewis.
Yeah. Soon they forget.
Yeah. He had a problem when... we asked him to come and dress as Grandpa Munster, and he said, "I can't. Universal Pictures owns the rights to this this image of him." So we did it step by step. It was like the factory worker who steals a Cadillac piece by piece. We said, "Okay, can you put on a tails and a white waistcoat?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Well, would you put on a white tie?" He said, "Yes." "Would you put on a cape with a red lining?" He said, "Yes." "Would you sort of make your lips red?" And he said, "Yes." And we got what we wanted.
And if I remember correctly, that was the first issue we were short, and short, well, that was in short supply.
Tam Janowitz, was a huge customer.
This was, again, as we kept trying to push the edge of our little envelope to do cool computer-generated images. We did this thing about feuds, this cover story, and it was out of this, I think, that Gore Vidal threatened to sue us, actually, for saying in the course of this cover story in a piece by Lynn Hirschberg that he was litigious.
I've spoken to Gore about this numerous times since, and he still does not get the humor or the irony of him threatening to sue us over calling him litigious. You've got to love that man.
This is Chevy Chase. A piece that Paul Rudnick and I wrote about irony that our future editor, Walter Kern, accused us of building a noose and hangman's gallows for ourselves by nailing what we were an emblem of. But the fact that we were able to pull off that thing as a graphic device was always pleased me.
And you've been doing it sort of reflexively ever since, right?
One has. Okay. I've never done it since. But, yeah.
This picture was so unfortunate. That is, she went out and had... You know that drastic remake she had done, it came within months after this.
I wonder why.
Again, it was a simple idea. It was, not an unretouched photograph.
Yes.
And the piece itself was a celebration of sorts.
You know? Yes, it was very mock celebratory. I think probably in the history of the magazine, it took more edit time on this story to get a certain voice right than I think everybody edited this story.
We did a thing every year called the Spy 100, beta days of everybody doing a list of 100s. I think you do that today, don't you? But, of course, George Bush, the good President Bush was president, and again, we used, that was back in the day, of course, when young people were doing that to their hair. And.
Matt Groening.
Before he was worth billions.
No, this was just a spy magazine, like what an explanatory, it was like Spy for Kids.
It's the issue in which a thing that now is, if Bruce Handy, who wrote it, had royalties, he'd be a rich man, because the thing he wrote in that issue about why there is no Santa, Spy for Kids, explaining that for children, is just the internet viral thing to end all internet viral things.
This came out 1 month after the Vanity Fair Demi Moore cover. Didn't pose for it. That's me.
I like you with the short hair, Graydon, yeah. I gotta say.
No, from the neck down.
Those all people all posed. This was a Wayne's World and Wayne Newton himself. When Wayne Newton became a kind of odd friend of the magazine at our fifth anniversary, he sang Spy Way, which was our version of the Frank Sinatra tune, My Way.
And, yeah, but if you look at his eyes, he's significantly drugged when you had him do this.
Some medication, certainly.
Oh. This appeared actually right at the beginning, January 1993. It was our kind of inaugural celebration of the beginning of the Clinton era.
She posed for it. That was before the whole Senate thing, before she, you know, wanted to run for office herself.
I find that oddly stimulating.
Pose
Did
for
I
us?
Say that aloud? Yeah. I can't believe it.
Oops.
Yeah, no computer at work. No, that was again early in the administration.
When you guys say no computer, what do you mean? What'd you do?
No, it was a joke, David.
No. You mean no computer work? Photoshop, is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, you guys were working with this Fred Flintstone sort of technology.
Except for this. I mean, we there was no money except for literally the $10,000, $20,000 computer bills to fool around with images like this. That was our one big budget item. Rich, skinny ladies.
This is by Nell Scovell, and she had a wonderful expression within the story that said how unfair it is that a woman who's a size 10 lives in a two-room apartment, and a woman who's a size 2 lives in a 10-room apartment.
Paul Rudnick wrote this about why trying to convince people that they didn't need to feel bad for disliking opera and poetry and ballet.
Well, it was at the time of the Mahabharata and those 9 operas at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
It was what it was. We did books of these. They were, and it's funny, people try to, this is done, obviously it was done before us, it has been done since. And it, thanks to Nikki Gossin, who's now a photo editor at Newsweek, the amount of the labor intensiveness of getting the right images was extraordinary. Although, in the case of Tammy Faye Baker and the Ewok, it was actually pretty easy. One of our many letters from Donald Trump, I don't know if you can read it, but it says, Dear Graydon, as per your letter of March 9th, I am surprised that you do not know who called me from Spy Magazine. Your curiosity will be satisfied in court, although, hopefully, that will not be necessary. Sincerely, Donald Trump.
He's such a great writer.
One of many fan letters he wrote to us. And the logo is just spectacular.
And that comes about a quarter inch off the paper. Yeah, too.
It's subtle, but it works for him.
And this is from our TV show. Right now. Oh. One of our TV shows in 1992.
Welcome to the 1992 Spy Magazine Hit List.
Glaube niemals, fremde Hilfe, niemals!
That NBC put Hitler's voice in a national politician, allowed us to do that on prime time, and it still just shocks me that was permitted even for the 12 seconds of it. So there's a little sample.
It occurs to me that I haven't actually introduced you people. George Kalograkis, deputy op-ed editor at the House of Many Doors, New York Times. Kurt Anderson, novelist, radio host, bunch of other stuff we all envy and covet. And Graydon Carter, the king of Vanity Fair, the editor actually is his formal title. Let's give him a round of applause. Isn't that really an elegant little switch of position there? Wow. I think it's easy to sort of minimize what the accomplishment of what these guys put together. They did this, you have to remember they did this back when celebrities were gods and the they weren't cat toys like they are now. Deconstruction, at least in the media, was something more likely to happen to a building on the Lower East Side. And media criticism, which Spy was full of, took place mostly in 200-word letters to the editor. If you think back, they presaged Clinton's downfall. I can remember a picture in the book where Clinton is standing at the top of the stairs and a woman is kind of staged at an unfortunate level, and the president, future president, is leering down at her, and it doesn't take a lot of imagination to sort of infer what might have happened next. You guys pointed out that Saddam Hussein was a fairly durable guy and might be around for a while, and that
Bob Dole,
yes,
back in the day.
A very good friend, and sort of predicted the Disney-fied Manhattan that we all ended up living in. I think it wouldn't be a spy event if we didn't sort of deal with the hanging trope in the room, which some might say is a word that begins with an I and ends in a Y, but whose name must not be spoken. These
what
guys,
are you talking about?
Irony, damn it, irony! Graydon said it's dead.
Great prediction.
All right. One of the things that I was thinking about was this book is put out by Miramax, which is owned by Disney, which used to be run by Michael Eisner, who was treated like a pinata is at an 8-year-old's birthday party by Spy. And yet here we are, right? George is an editor at the New York Times, where I also work, but it was an institution that was first knocked off its pedestal by Spy before anyone did it. The Times was untouchable before that. Graydon sort of made the quick trip from guerrilla sniper to fortified target and now presides over an Oscar party that is sort of a spy charticle waiting to happen. And Kurt, with his multi-platform genius, you know, the historical novel, the avuncular radio host, the magazine columnist of New York Magazine. You'd think on general principle that Spy would have turned him into red mist in an afternoon, something you'd tuck away after lunch. So let's stipulate that the right and decent thing to do after you all were at Spy would have been to kill yourselves, I think. Right? I mean, that would have been the honorable thing. Instead, you went out and got jobs and continued to live and do work. But be that as it may, I was wondering why at 20 years it felt like the right time to put this book together. Did you guys finally begin speaking to each other again, or?
No.
We don't speak.
No, okay. Actually, no.
I was in the green room with stony silence the whole time.
That's
so
true.
Cold.
It was supposed to come out last year, the 19th anniversary, and just 20 seemed like a rounder, chunkier, more appropriate way to do it. It was literally procrastination that made it 20 years.
On whose part?
On mine.
No, Greg and I wanted to take, you know, the easy man's way out and just do a kind of greatest hits thing. And George, who's a hard worker, had independently this idea of doing a history, so we merged the idea. That's how this came about.
But I do think that it would have been too soon after 10 years or something. It was like going, not
it
quite
might
going back
soon
to
after
high
20
school.
As well.
Maybe. It's like going back to graduate school, if not high school. I mean, there's a point where it's time to look back, and a point where you don't want to. But.
Yeah, it felt like the right retrospective.
That and the fact check from Miramax sort of helped things a lot.
Didn't hurt.
Okay. I thought it was interesting you guys put the book together in a collaborative fashion. Of course, what you did is actually annotate George's work, but that Spy, which was this thing of sort of networked. Aggregated thought. You kind of went the same way with the book. Is it? I mean, was that conscious on your part, or?
It was a small version. But like when we edited Spy, Kurt and I sat like this far away from each other for 5 years and spent from early in the morning to late at night many days there. And we'd have lunch together. We'd often have dinner together. So
sleep together, bunk together.
We actually did when we
keep going.
Not in the same bed, but in the same room on the road. But it was a sort of a more relaxed vacation version of that.
And so all we knew how to do together.
Gotta fix your mic.
Oh, yes, you did.
Yeah, it's fell off.
I can shout.
Let's get some tin cans and some coconuts up here.
Okay.
There we go.
So we just sort of reverted to the way we'd worked in the past, ordering George around and editing each other's stuff. And then Alex Isley, who was one of our great art directors, came and designed the book. And it was like going home for Christmas and falling back into the old patterns, for better or worse, that one does as a child.
I can attest to that. It was like writing a very long piece for Spy. You know, Spy was edited in a way that the stories would go around and around, and different people would put things in on different drafts. So we did many drafts of the history, and just like the old days.
Well, I have to say it worked. I think it's just a wonderful book, and everybody I've given it to has said the same thing. The thingness of it, the craft of it, its touch, its feel.
Well, also because of those typefaces, because we didn't use sort of exaggerated typefaces of the 1980s or wacky typefaces of humor magazines, and they are classical typefaces. They stand up well over time, so you can still put out a magazine, a book that is purports to be somewhat funny, but it still looks like something sort of clean and classical.
No, and you know, again, thanks to Alex and Miramax. I mean, we wanted it to be a beautifully crafted artifact, but not take itself too seriously. So there's holes punched in the cover just to sort of subvert itself a little bit.
That's the effect I got exactly when I saw it.
There you go.
It's weird.
That's what we're going for, David.
One of the things that I wondered about is what you guys are willing. I mean, when I looked at the book and looked at the spreads, I said, well, I don't know a ton about magazines, but that was the first time that graphics and words danced in that particular way. But I also got the impression when I looked at it, I don't know if it's really come together that way since. I suppose Graydon would argue that you know, Vanity Fair is at the vanguard of typography and photography and words all together. But it still looked kind of modern to me. I mean, when you were looking at pages, did you go, these seem dated and a little weird, or did they seem sort of fresh to you?
But David, we actually didn't set out to create something that looked sort of chic of its time or modern or anything like that. The actual sort of the lack of money inspired a lot of the ideas that then went on to other places, like the little silhouetted heads. It's because we had no money for photography, and so by using those as like decorative elements, it gave the magazine a certain look. And we crammed, because we could only print so many pages in the magazine, we crammed more and more things onto an individual page, and the type kept getting smaller and smaller. And things actually look more intelligent when the type is smaller than if a type is really big. And I think that all these sort of factors of not having anything to work with sort of played to our favor. Also, one of the things that made the, we were talking about this earlier today, what made the magazine different is it didn't have any of the things that other magazines do. There was no service section, there were no reviews, there were no contributors pages.
In fact, the first discussions began as
having none of those.
What won't we do? Because it was a lark. It wasn't like, oh, let's start a magazine. And it was really almost like a game for ourselves as we, you know, we were having lunch to say, well, how could you do a magazine without all this? And a city magazine is what we conceived of.
Okay, so stimulated. Without all these, but I'm interested, things. Sort of what moved it off the cocktail napkin and into this thing that you can hold? Was it something about the times, the relationship of you guys, the fact that there was all this talent floating around? What made it actually come to pass? Made the greatest magazine ever in our mind.
Well, that was Tom Phillips had a lot to do with that because he quit his job at Rothschild, and which sort of alarmed us. We thought
sort of called your bluff.
We're still fooling around, and he's made us sit down and write 100 story ideas, and which is a sort of very logical and mature thing to do, but we hadn't certainly thought of it. And once you start doing the story ideas, it actually gave you a form of roughly what this thing with magazine would look like. And then Tom was very effective at raising money, and we had a very good record for raising money. We didn't have much to show anybody. We had a manifesto that was printed at the by the Life magazine, or the Time Life printer, because we both worked there at the time. They didn't realize this was a Time Inc. startup, but it because they didn't have a piece of it, but it was. But people who decided to invest in the magazine bought lunch in celebration of the gesture, and those who didn't invest in the magazine felt so badly they picked up the tab anyway. So we had almost zero startup costs prior to raising all the money.
But getting a third person, we could have gone on like that for years, just saying, and our ideal magazine will be this, and our ideal magazine will be that. A third guy, as Graydon says, who suddenly quits his high-paying Wall Street job to do it with us, we felt, God, I guess we got to do this just to keep him employed.
Well, isn't part of the reason that people gave you some money, not a bunch, and bought you lunch when they didn't, is that you guys actually showed up in like hula skirts and coconuts when it was time to pitch, did a little dance?
You may have been reading some other part of the story. I don't remember. No, we actually dressed very conservatively throughout the entire run of Spy. We wore jackets and ties most of the time because
it's unlike now,
a greater disguise as a, if you're going to write sort of revolutionary type things, I think it's better to look like a Wall Street banker than a long hair.
I wonder when you look at, you consume your daily media diet and you watch Jon Stewart and you maybe stop by Gawker and you or someone like you is reading Lucky, that if you look at the sort of B-list nation that we live in, how much of it do you either take credit or blame for in terms of how the conversation is framed?
Not that much.
Actually, not. I mean, when we sat down, when you sit down to read this, write this book, and read this book, frankly, you think about all drawing the lines of ancestry and family tree, but and there are particular graphic devices or things you look at, but it's not like. I think we stand over on our balcony and say, this is the world we made, or anything.
The credit
like it.
And blame are...
At least I don't.
No.
What do you think the accounted for the fact that, now, on a business level, it's sort of tanked coming out of the gate. 3 months, right? It had some cert trouble and...
Although, to be fair, we ran out of money quickly because we were printing too many copies.
Okay.
And because it was being embraced and we had to print all these copies so it was the pain of success at the beginning.
What accounted for the subsequent like explosion in appetite, coverage, embrace? Well, apart from the fact that it was good.
It was not a big, I mean, magazines start off with like huge projections of where they want to get now. We started off with the 25,000 circulation, and we were very happy with that for the first year, and we were going to platform it the way they did movies before Jaws. You know, they'd open it like two theaters in New York, two theaters in LA, and then it would sort of increase over, say, a six-week period. But where we actually ran into trouble is we had to start, the LA wanted copies, then Houston wanted copies, and Boston, and our budget and the money we raised didn't allow for that kind of growth. It allowed for, you know, arithmetic growth rather than exponential growth.
And before there was such a thing as viralness, there was word of mouth, and so somehow people in Austin and Seattle, you know, started wanting to read it. So who knows how that happened, also, really? Because there was no marketing.
And there was no competition. That was another
yes.
thing. You know, as Curtis said, I think we were the only game in town. So we also attracted the people who got what we were doing and wanted to work there or write for it or draw for it.
Also, if you grew up in this, if you grew up in this so-called sticks, like I did, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, reading Mad Magazine was the first magazine that sort of explained things to you and explained things that are in, they're in. I grew up in Canada, but they explained these sort of major things that were happening in America in a way that a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old could understand. And I think for a lot of people, it was people who wanted for Spy Magazine. It was people who wanted to live in New York, but through consequences or age or whatever it is, couldn't live in New York at that moment.
Yeah, but when I was looking at it, I thought to myself, why did it go out of business? What happened?
First of all,
I read the book and watched it, but in sort of a more meta sense, general sense, what was wrong with it? It seemed like it was filling a need, reader interest, assembled a tribe that people would want to advertise against. Everything about it seemed...
But if you look at the magazine business, there are, except for magazines that have foundations behind them, like Harper's or The Nation, there are no standalone magazines. And the fact is that this had never occurred to us when we were starting it is quite remarkable. And that the fact that the investors, that it had never occurred to
them. So during downturns, there's a big recession in 1990-91. If you're part of a big company, you can obviously weather that. And that was much harder.
We knew nothing about how to actually sort of make friends with advertisers. When we started this magazine, we didn't realize that you can go to designers and borrow clothing for a cover shoot. So we would go down to Mo Ginsburg or some cheap discount place and buy the clothing for, like, you know, suits for $149. And whereas if we'd borrowed the clothes from a designer, the designer might have looked favorably upon us and then stuck an ad in the magazine.
Yeah. Is that how it works?
I don't know.
The
in public radio, that's what they do. I know that.
Nice one. I wonder, apart from kind of like the durable punching bags like Trump, who were your real, true, mortal enemies and/or secret admirers? If you look back, like, you know, you did Oprah. She said she forgave you. Did Kissinger ever forgive you for that Bohemian Grove thing? What do you guys talk about?
He probably never said.
I think if you call a man a number of times a socialite war criminal in the pages of a magazine, I wouldn't wait around for the day he's going to forgive you.
Although I'm friendly with his son. And I remember Bob Kerry, the president of the New School, has told me that issue with Henry Kissinger and Merv Griffin wearing coconut bras is was the favorite magazine cover of his young adulthood. So there you go.
And I remember being at a cocktail party and Abe Rosendahl and Shirley Lord, who did take a
severe
lot of
pummeling.
Month after month after month after month. And I remember sitting at the office one day and one of the interns came in and said, Abe Rosendahl was in front of me at the video store. I said, really? And he said, yeah, he was running out all these porn tapes. I said, really? So I said, like what? And so I just jot down the names. And there's Felicity saying, I remember we had sort of epithets for a lot of people. We had Larry Tisch, we called a churlish dwarf billionaire. And John Scanlon, who was representing him at the time, was his PR guy, was a very good friend. And he calls me up and he's really indignant. He said, Graydon, you've just gone too far with this. He said, for one thing, Larry is not technically a dwarf. So I just wrote I wrote that down, not technically a dwarf, and we put that in the magazine the next month.
What about any secret admirers who people you stapled who came up and said, you know, it's nasty, it's horrible. I really like the magazine, though.
Harvey Weinstein, for instance. No, we did early on in Miramax's rise, very one of the early rough kind of vivisections of Miramax.
And the compliment came after he threatened to kill you.
Well, yes. Okay. But you know, it's all a piece. Right. You know.
The strong embrace of Harvey's love.
You know.
It's warming.
Harvey was going to be here tonight, but he got hung up in L.A. I wonder if you could help us a little bit, George, in terms of kind of, you've got these two guys, and you could say, well, Spy was a collective enterprise, but it was sort of like a wiki that only two people were allowed to finally alter in the end. And a lot of times, you had strong-voiced writers who came in with great pieces that you ran. Other people's work was more sort of dots on screen to be reiterated as you might choose. And I'm wondering what it is in either, you know, the Keith and Mick, Ozzy and Harriet, like who was the good mom, who was the bad mom, what it was about these two guys. I mean, you'd never do a psychic sort of separated at birth. They're very different guys. So why did that end up working?
Well, I think Susan Morrison says this in the book, that we began to learn after a while which of the two of them would be more receptive to a certain idea. So we play them off each other, basically. Not always to our advantage, but they were never, you know, they were seldom that far apart. It was odd having two editors in chief in a way, but.
It was weird. It was a weird setup.
Yeah. I mean, is there another
but
example?
It didn't come off as weird in the book. It seems like, unless George left a lot on the cutting room floor, I mean.
Not that, no.
It's just, you know, we had this idea together, we did it together, it didn't, you know.
I know if I'd put out the magazine on my own, it wouldn't have been a tenth of the magazine that we did with Kurt. It doubled and tripled by doing it two people together. I think it, and it wasn't, but it was a very fluid thing from the very first day. There was no sort of A-B thing. It was just always fluid. Everything sort of went around in a circle. And the office was very collegial. You know, when I read the book, I thought we had a sort of reasonably good time, but we were always worried about money and a million other things. If you were 21 years old and this was your first job, and there was one point in during this thing we used to do, the Iron Man Nightlife Decathlon, and two of the interns, Bob Mack and John Brody, they had to infiltrate a Priscilla Rotazzi and Chris Whittle's wedding on Georgia Pond. And they, you know, they're at the dark of night, they're taking it like a Zodiac boat across Georgia Pond, James Bond style, with dinner jackets on, so they would fit in with the people in the wedding. And for, you know, if that's your first job, it's downhill from there, because nothing's as much fun as that.
One of the things that you even though you're kind of different guys, you do have this sort of from other placeness going on, and where
that's
you're,
code
you're,
for
you're
Canadian.
From that place called Canada,
and I'm from Southern Canada, Nebraska.
Southern Canada, right. Nebraska, and there's a tradition in New York media dating back to Harold Ross and probably before it, of rustics coming in from the
Clay Felker too.
Yes, Clay Felker, people coming from other places and experiencing New York with some degree of shock, but not really awe, that the town never really got over on them. And the fact that you were from a long ways away, you were from a long ways away, you were from the Bronx, so that sort of counts. Although your dad is a New York shrink, so that brings you a little closer into the, and you did end up on the Upper West.
That's true.
We were in awe. I think at least I certainly was in awe of the city. It was not, I was not blasé about it at all. In fact, I still am not blasé about it.
No, there was a certain, you know, Gershwin soundtrack, literally sometimes, and certainly figuratively. But point taken that we were enough outsiders to be astounded, appalled, whatever, struck by
and enthralled by the whole circus too.
When I first came to New York, I actually went to work for Kurt, which will account for any sort of face licking I do on this panel. We worked at, okay. All right, hand-holding, whatever you want. We worked at Stair at Lehigh. Now, you tried to sell a magazine in 1991, the deepest media recession.
Did sell a magazine in 1991?
Yeah.
For a dime?
For a pair of pants.
Yeah.
And you started an internet media company in 1999, 2000, 2001, right?
Yes.
So stipulate, you're a great market timer. But anyways, we were... you're writing a historical novel in a YouTube age, too. So you tend to counter program.
There you go.
At times, okay. That's what I meant to say. But I can remember being...
Is that the face-licking part?
Yes. this ends in a hug, believe me.
Okay.
I can remember being at Stair at Lehigh, 13th floor, we're faced north, and it was my first day in New York. I fell off a turnip truck like 6 years ago. It was at night, by the way. And looking up at Midtown, Kurt came around the corner by the coffee thing, and I was just staring at Midtown and taking it in, and it took my breath away. And one of the things you said to me is, you know what? That keeps on happening. This city will not let you down. Do you think New York, as it is today, is as charming, as wonderful, as rich a newsbed as Spy Magazine fell into? I mean, there's a lot more clutter to fight through.
I would have to say, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, Times Square is now what it is as opposed to what it was then, and there are all of the versions of that, but, yeah, you know.
I feel the opposite. I feel that the city is now there just for money, that it's impossible to be middle class in New York City and have your kids in schools, that it's all about hedge fund money. Very little of that money flows to the city, sticks to the people actually who help make the city run. And I think that, very few writers live in New York now because they can't afford it. And I know in our staff at Vanity Fair, almost the entire sort of assistant level staff, they all live in Brooklyn. And they live in the far, you know,
and,
reaches
and what's
of Brooklyn.
Wrong with that?
No. Brooklyn's the hip borough. But it, the city is just too expensive now. And I think that, it's very suburban and, you know, no smoking, no trans fats, and that's not what New York was when we got here.
It was a city of trans fats. It really was.
And we just lucked into that, you know? Right.
Skyscrapers and trans fat was what brought us here.
Other things have changed, and, you know, Updike talked, I think it was Updike that talked about liking things with edges, whether it's this book, which is sort of die-cut elegance, or Spy, which had edges every which way you wanted to think about it. Do you think in a post-internet age, and I'm interested in what you think, because you and I have talked before about this being kind of, that there is no general interest per se anymore, and yet Graydon edits a very successful general interest magazine. So I wonder if there, let's say you had, instead of Cy Newhouse, instead wanted to put $100 million into a portfolio, he wanted to drop something into the next version of Spy, would it have a shot?
I think it'd be very tough. I Vanity Fair is what it is, and The New Yorker is what it is, New York Magazine is what it is, The New York Times is what it is. They were grandfathered in, effectively, before the internet existed, or before this era of a zillion channels, including the web existed. So I think to start a thing that we lucked out in a million ways, among them being that, you know, there weren't 10 or 100 other things trying to do what we were doing. So, you know, we were lucky in our little tiny way to have the impact we did. That would be very tough to do these days.
Also, we would have, if we started this up again, if we were starting up today, we'd probably do it on the internet. We wouldn't do a print version at all. There'd be absolutely no point to it.
Do you ever think to yourself, George, when you look around, you say, well, Spy is everywhere. But Spy is really nowhere in terms of, like, pulling the trigger and really finishing somebody off. Mm.
That may be a good thing.
Spy's been everywhere in my life for the last few years, so I don't feel that. But
Gosh, you mean, are you talking about
it seems
like
ubiquitous,
Trump,
but there's nothing really like it, is there?
Ah, so there should be something like it, otherwise we failed.
Why does there got to be a dig in there? I'm just trying to run. No, maybe it speaks to the sui generisness of what you built in the first place. But people could say, well, you know, Spy's unholy spawn is every which way. Forget that image. But in a way, there isn't really anything like it.
Well, it's probably true that you know, the people who deserve to be scared are scared of, that's probably true. I mean, there's probably the same aggregate amount of whatever, vitriol, mischief-making, mockery, all that, but it's just spread around.
Well, also the money is, there are many more, you know, multimillionaires and billionaires in New York today than there were in the 80s. But in the 80s, they really showed off. I mean, it was a real parade, and you could see the money. The money here now, it's very, you know, it's sort of damped down and quiet and, you know, shuffled off to Greenwich or, you know, sort of offshore, basically.
And it was new. I mean, you know, the New York was practically bankrupt 10 years before we started. And so when we started, it was this first flush of boom time.
Yeah, some of those Nouveau Riche people became, by now they're practically old money. I mean, they've had a lot of...
Or no money in a lot of cases as well.
There's that. One of the things I wonder, there is such a touch of the absurd. And when you go back and look at Spy, I mean, you think of Sammy Davis, there's a lot of ways to go with that. But in the page I was looking at, it was kind of a muse for cubism. And so you're going Sammy Davis, cubism, and I'm thinking to myself, I wonder what drugs went into that. Was it an opium thing? Was it a coke thing? And then I talk to you guys and I find out, not really.
No, but that's a good example of things we did, which I love that we did. Like, it was called People Who Look Like Art. And Sammy Davis looked cubist because of his eye and everything. And again, it was just this strange conceit that we did. You know, Keith Richards looked like a Klimt. People say, oh, yes, you were mean to everyone, you did this. We also just had these curious little conceits that we relentlessly pushed to to make a 10-page feature out of. So, if there are any Spy alumni in the audience who want to contradict us about there being not a lot of, you know, drugginess.
Well, you could see
as far as I was concerned, there was no drugs in the office, and first of all, we never paid anybody enough money for them to have drugs. It wasn't the intent, but it was the net result. There was drinking.
So brown liquor and desperation produced this kind of creativity.
In equal measure.
And just, you know, instead of, you know, if you work in a magazine, you work at anything, there are special brainstorming sessions and editorial meetings, and to a degree I've never encountered since, it was pretty constantly that way. I mean, yeah, we had meetings, but there it was. Everybody, as George talks about in the book, I mean, there was this sense of taking pleasure in a seed of an idea and carrying it on to another, to a bigger seedling, and so it was not like a lot of wow, people who look like art, man, kind of conceptualization.
You do that very well for somebody who hasn't had practice.
No.
Graydon promised me if I did this that you would reveal who Celia Brady was and you'd finally lay it out there and tell us. Who was she, Kurt?
Oh, all right. She was our Hollywood columnist, and she still is well employed in Hollywood. It's amazing that, I mean, you know, we know who Deep Throat is, but we don't know who Celia Brady is. It's amazing to me that that's lasted.
Why do you think she hasn't... I mean, there still is no great sort of industry gossip columnist. I mean, it filled such a need at the time, and then just it kind of went...
Well, again, interestingly, you think back and you look back, just as the New York Times was unchallenged, as you said, and so that was scary and interesting to do, our column about them, you know, people like Michael Ovitz and Michael Eisner were then, and their equivalents are now, not very rarely, criticized or teased or made fun of. So that was, was extraordinary at the
also,
time.
Also, Ovitz, it happened sort of one night around 1987 at the Oscars. Three people who accepted Oscars thanked Michael Ovitz. And we came in the next day and said, who the fuck's Michael Ovitz? So we discovered that he's this super powerful agent out there, and we try to get some photographs of him, and there are no photographs of him. He's bought up every single photograph of himself, as had Michael Milken at the time. And so with that kind of mystery, that bred sort of curiosity, and it was the first magazine to introduce Michael Ovitz to the sort of the popular world, and it in Hollywood, none of the newspapers in Hollywood have a gossip column, so that there's no industry, anything out there. So this came as a sort of a jolt of freshness to them.
And we were too stupid in that particular case to have sold out. About a few months before, we started wondering who Michael Ovitz was. One of the things that led us to wonder that is these three agents from CAA called us up. It's about a year, not quite a year into Spy, and said, you know, we want to represent you. We want to put you in Hollywood. And we go, oh, who are you? What's this? And literally, we were that clueless about, you know, the opportunities to sell out that we then went ahead and burned our bridge.
And as it is, the book, if it does well, probably outperform the magazine in terms of what you pulled out of Spy.
Well, isn't that rude to even suggest that kind of money talk, David? No, it personally, yeah, that's probably true.
Okay.
Although just, we had this, George got most of it.
Just checking. I was wondering why you guys treated him with so much deference. One of the things I found myself wondering when I was looking at the book is how would you have maneuvered past 9/11? It would have been, you know.
We would have declared irony dead, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, dead bodies everywhere, la 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 la, you know, and just waited for satire.
Well, the tail end of the 90s for the editors who were there, I think it was a much more difficult period than the tail end of the 80s when we were there. It just, the city had sort of drained out a lot. It was not the sort of hothouse that it was. And that first flush of sort of 80s money and exuberance and sort of non-bankruptcy in New York.
And Us Magazine had become sort of spyified, and EW had become sort of spyified, and there was an internet. So it was just tougher all the way around, I think, to do it. So, you know, your question of how 9/11 would have happened is so sort of triply hypothetical, it's even hard to imagine. Although, you know.
So the question sucked, basically.
Oh, David, I'm not your editor anymore. So.
The one of the things I thought about was the in the book, Graydon, you're the mercurial young man moving from thing to thing, and yet now you seem to have found a job where you're not tilting toward the next thing, where you've found a way to reinvent where you are, maybe making movies while you do it, maybe bringing in new people. Is that just a fact that you've grown up, or you've finally found a megaphone that sort of suits you?
Well, Vanity Fair is whatever you want to make it, and I made it into something that I feel comfortable with, and a job that I absolutely adore. It has a great influence, and I've got more war reporters than society reporters at the magazine now. So, I've been there almost 15 years, and I just can't imagine going anywhere else. It's the surrounded by friends at the magazine and long-standing colleagues, and why would you leave that job?
What I want, you know, for the longest.
Also, I don't get any offers.
For the longest time. You guys were pushed up against the glass, pointing at all these sort of exotic fish in the aquarium, and suddenly you went through the glass and ended up on the other side. I'm sure that wasn't the business plan, per se, is let's build out bright, shiny futures for ourselves. But doesn't it feel a little weird how things turn out?
Sure. You know.
But it's weird in small incremental steps.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not. You mean the ironies of the situation?
any job after Spy, I said, is ironic, you know, I mean, for us.
No, your question, I mean, yeah, we should have all died in a, you know, limo accident on Lafayette Street in 1991, and then, you know.
Would have been a great story.
Well, there you go.
Actually, one time we were on it, we had a Spy, we used to have these Spy
clothes. Not that we took limos.
We used to have this Spy closing dinner at a restaurant or something like that. At one point, we had it on a boat. We thought, what would happen if the boat sank and we all died? And Jamie Malinowski imagined the headline, "Now who's laughing?" Which I
thought. Well, Graydon hated all of us riding the same elevator, it has to be said, too. We'd split up just in case, you know.
That's what they say about journalism, is your assets take the elevator every single night. I wonder if... you know, one headline I read, a friend in need is not as good as a friend with a house in Tuscany. It's Do you remember who wrote that?
Jim Collins' friendship piece, I think.
I mean, it's such a crisp and clear thought. And I mean, it really stands for the ages, doesn't it?
No, it was, well, Jim Collins is and was a great writer and has just sold a novel to Little Brown. So everybody can buy his beautiful work in a year.
Why do you think so many, we'll get to questions in a moment, but so many of you guys, went on to television, right?
Starting at a certain point, yeah. Well, when we started making television shows, they all saw, I can be paid hundreds of thousands of dollars doing this thing, or $34,000 doing this thing, and so right. they all got poached, but yeah.
And then one would attract another. A lot of them wound up at Letterman, then there was a long sort of flood to The Simpsons. And there was a period there, I remember, there were 4 or 5 writers out of 10 were former Spy people.
So that's how you ended up with the clip, I guess.
Tim Long, who was had been an intern at Spy, was the executive producer of The Simpsons.
Are you guys ready to ask some questions? Good, I'm glad. Do we have some mics out there, or how are we going to do it, Paul?
The mics, if you could come up to the mic, that would be very helpful.
We can't really see you, so you're just going to have to start shouting at us. No.
The mics are here.
There we go.
Do I get to go first? I was thinking as I was listening to this how so many of the phrases that you use to describe people, you know, the bosomy, dirty book writer and short-fingered vulgarian have stuck in my head the way that you know, the wine dark sea does, and so I was just wondering, Graydon, what was it like the first time you met Cy Newhouse after Spy? Because you had a particularly good phrase for him, which is I'm sure half the people here know. I forget it. I think it involved the word short, but I don't quite remember. But what was that like for you?
Well, he. Cy, it's funny because he tried to buy Spy at one point, but we didn't talk much about it for a couple of years after I joined the magazine. And then at one point we were having dinner at the Connaught in London, and he said, "You know something? I wish you'd done a column on Condé Nast like you did on the Times." And I said, "Why?" He said, "So then I'd know what was going on." So he took this sort of thing rolls off Cy like, you know, he really nothing could bother Cy. But with Shirley Lord, I know that people immediately, their eyes when they were introduced to her, they immediately went to her chest to see if in fact she was bosomy, and people's eyes go to Donald Trump's hands very quickly.
And he's had them surgically lengthened, I think.
But also that was a style we sort of picked up a bit from Time magazine where we both worked, and of just this sort of very dense, adjective-filled writing style. And in fact, at Time in the 1940s and 50s, they were not that far from Bosie Bernie book writer.
Beetle-eyed fellow traveler.
Yeah,
exactly.
In the life of Spy, how many libel lawsuits did you have? Did anybody win big, or do you have any amusing stories about those lawsuits?
Good question.
There were, during our era, no libel suits, no suits filed. There was, and somebody can correct me, there was a suit filed after we all left by Steven Seagal that, and that's really why the magazine died. No, he withdrew the suit. He was persuaded to withdraw his lawsuit.